So what we'll do is we'll make a start on this next session, and then we can get stuck into your next lab. So the labs this afternoon are going to start taking a really long time to get through. So we're going to try and make sure we can get through it in a reasonable time so we can go down at 5:30 and start drinks. Sound good? So this section is normally the session that we start getting a lot of questions because it's about storage, it's about networks, it's about a fair few things that you're all going to be interested in. So what we're going to discuss in this session is increasing the data center scale through network advantages, as well as the storage solutions that we have. We're also going to cover off disk deduplication, as well as storage spaces. Okay? So a lot of you I know have already been asking me about storage and networks and other things as well during the breaks. So we're going to cover a lot of that stuff now. And I'll get Craig to come up and do a disk deduplication demonstration as well. And then you'll get stuck into your lab to do data deduplication. So some of the challenges that we're addressing in 2012 R2 are around enabling high-scale operations and keeping the TCO low. Okay? Trying to come up with ways to keep your costs down but keep the same high availability and scalability that you have today, or if not, improve on it. Reduce your server footprint and lower the facility costs. So we're trying to improve density of your VMs on the hosts, but also try and reduce the amount of big tiered hardware that you need to put into the environment. So the ways we're trying to address that is being able to have bigger host clusters so that we can get better VM density. Also, flexible network virtualization, so enabling those hybrid clouds, those virtual networks that are isolated. And then the big one, which there's a lot of hype about and a lot of discussion about at the moment, is storage spaces, okay, and storage tiering. They're two probably the big buzzwords that are flying around the storage arena at the moment is around how can we deliver tiering of storage, whether it's the Microsoft storage spaces and tiering, or whether it's your third-party vendors delivering that same type of technology. We're also talking about SMB3 application support. So we're adding more and more applications that can use SMB3. Originally, it was your file share clusters, so file sharing, and then we added Hyper-V, and then we added SQL, and I'm sure there'll be other products that start using SMB3 as a storage solution. We're also finding that we're getting much better high-speed hardware into your environments. As you all know, the cores that are getting in CPUs are adding up and up and up. The number of CPUs we can put in boxes is increasing as well. Not to mention the amount of RAM that we can throw in the boxes now as well. So being able to deliver a high-performing, continuous available storage solution is becoming critical as we move forward with the virtualization platforms. So some of the ways we increase and get better density is through scalability enhancements, but also NUMA-aware technology. How many of you are actually aware, besides the people that were here earlier for a discussion, how many people are actually aware of NUMA technology and what it does? A couple? Okay. For those that aren't aware, if you've bought a server in the last couple of years, your servers have NUMA technology in them. Okay? The NUMA technology is the technology that enables the CPU and RAM and cache to work better in sync. Okay? Realistically, you don't see a huge improvement in performance until you get above 4 cores. Okay? Once you get above 4 cores, you'll start to see some pretty significant improvements in performance. So when you start having VMs or physical boxes that have more than 4 cores being used simultaneously, you will see a performance increase. So some of the new features in R2 that weren't in 2012 are network virtualization with the gateways device, VRSS, NIC teaming has been improved. Okay, we had NIC teaming in 2012, but it's been improved in R2. The SMB3's had a bit of performance increasing and tuning. Dynamic virtual machine queuing. Okay, we'll go through what that means shortly. IP address management has also been improved. And we now have the storage tiering capability within storage spaces, etc. So the way we've improved scalability and density is through the virtual machine NUMA technology as well as dynamic memory. So your hosts, as I said earlier, were able to support up to 320 logical processors and 4 terabytes of memory per host. Okay? We also have the support for up to 1,024 machines per host. Clusters, 64 nodes, and we're able to support up to 64 virtual procs and 1 terabyte of memory in a VM. Okay? What we have to evaluate when you design your environments is, are you scaling up or scaling out? Are you going to buy bigger servers, beefier servers with more CPUs and RAM? Or are you going to buy lots of smaller CPUs? So are you going to buy four proc boxes? Are you going to buy 2 proc boxes? Are you going to try 8 or 12 proc boxes? Okay? There's always an ROI on investment, so you need to do your evaluations on what's going to work out cost effective for you. So again, it's scale or scale up. How are we going to scale out? So the NUMA technology, so the topology on top of a virtual machine, on top of a physical, is that the NUMA technology is passed through to the virtual machine. So as long as your hardware is aware of NUMA technology, you're running Windows Server 2012, any applications and OSs that are running in your virtual machines that support NUMA technology will take advantage of that NUMA technology. Okay? So if you're running IIS 8 or IIS 7 as a web server, it knows about NUMA technology, so if you're running it on a VM, you'll be able to take advantage of that technology. Dynamic memory. Yep. No, so there are so the question is, can you configure NUMA technologies on a per VM basis? There are configuration options for NUMA on the VMs. So if you go into your VM settings, you'll be able to configure NUMA technology capabilities. Okay? So dynamic memory has enabled us to get better density because we're sharing memory between servers when they're needed. We're also setting minimum and startup memories. So if you've got a server that needs to boot really quickly, you can set a startup memory so that when it starts up, it uses more RAM. And then once it's started, you can set a minimum amount and it'll drop back down. Okay? So if you really need to fast boot servers, you can increase the RAM that they boot with and then drop it back. We have smart paging, memory ballooning, as well as some runtime configuration options now. So the way the memory works is you set your minimum memory, your startup memory, and your maximum memory. The startup memory is what we boot with. We then, once we've booted, drop back down to the minimum memory, and then once the server's operational, it will start using dynamic memory as required. So it'll scale up and down the memory as your applications need it. You can also now, with R2, modify, and Windows 2012 is modify the maximum memory without having to reboot the box. Okay, so you can up the RAM. You can't decrease it, but you can up it without rebooting the server. We also now have Hyper-V smart paging. So it's a reliable way to keep a VM running when no physical memory is available. Okay, so just like other platforms, we can write to disk if we have to when there's no memory. Performance will be degraded because disk is always much slower than what your RAM is. So the paging can be used in the following situations: VM restarts, when there's no physical memory available, or no memory can be reclaimed from other virtual machines on that host. So in this environment, we have VM 1, 2, and N. We have the startup memory in use. The memory in use is after the startup. So we're able to reclaim some of the memory using the page system. Server management enhancements. Okay, Server Manager 2012 enables us to manage Windows 2012 servers without having to connect to the actual server. Gone are the days when you used to have to connect to or IDP or go to the console of a server to install features and roles. You don't have to go to that machine to launch Computer Manager. You can do it remotely through Server Manager. Okay? Server Manager means that you should no longer have admins fighting over who's getting kicked off the console because they need to do something on the server. All right? If an admin is connecting nowadays or RDPing to a server, they really shouldn't be. All right? With Windows 2012, you should be able to manage 2012 servers from a single point. You install Server Manager on a desktop. Okay, if you're running Windows 8, you can deploy Server Manager on your desktop, or you could create a management server and manage servers from that Server Manager console. So we'll do a demonstration of that a little bit later. Network. We have the network functionality, so we have our Hyper-V virtual switch and virtual network. We have SRIOV availability to offload to hardware. We have virtual receive side scaling. We have IP address management and dynamic virtual machine queuing in R2. We also have our NIC teaming and SMB3 protocols as well. So we're going to go through in a little bit more detail around the NIC teaming, the SMB multi-channel, as well as the IP address management shortly. So the SRIOV virtualization is where we're starting to look at offloading some of the network traffic and decisions across off to the hardware. So it's a standard that allows PCI Express devices to be shared by multiple VMs. It's more direct hardware path for I/O. We're reducing the network latency by taking the CPU utilization for processing traffic off the CPU. We're passing it to the network adapters. You need to have an SRIOV-capable physical NIC that contains virtual functions that are securely mapped to VMs. Okay? The downside, though, is that the SRIOV bypasses the virtual extensible switch. Okay? So you can potentially lose the virtualization capabilities. However, SRIOV is fully supported for live migration traffic. Okay? So if you've got network adapters that you want to use, but you're not going to use them for VM traffic, you're going to use them for managing or live migration, you can turn on SRIOV on those network adapters and you won't affect any virtualization products. So you have your VM network stack, you have your synthetic NIC. When we go to SRIOV, we're going through a virtual function, not going through the synthetic NIC and the Hyper-V extensible switch.
Going back to the SRVIO disabling the extensible switch, I remember you said that earlier. Does it now make sense, even though we can do all this amazing teaming now, to have four NICs so that you've got two for the management and live migration to use SRIOV and then have two for VM traffic where you have it off?
So the question is it best practice or should we start looking at having four NICs potentially in the server, two NICs that we team together for management and live migration, which we can enable SRIOV on, and then have two NICs that we team together for VM traffic? The answer is yes and no. Okay? Personally, we normally do designs around eight NICs, okay? Because we normally have some larger designs when we scale out. So it really comes down to your scale, though. Okay, four NICs may suit your environment. We're seeing a lot of customers deploy 8 10-gig NICs now for HA reasons. We normally have potentially two NICs teamed for management, okay, because that management network is used when you're deploying VMs, if you're not offloading to your SAN. Okay, so when you use VMM to deploy a VM, it's going to use that management network to connect to the host to deploy the VM to the storage, okay? The other solution is we always normally like to have a NIC for live migration. You potentially will need a NIC for backup, okay? So your backup traffic from the host to your backup solution. We then also look at two for your storage, okay? If you're not using HBAs, if you're using 10 gig Ethernet, there's two for the storage, or SMB, you could potentially have two for the storage for SMB, or you could still traditionally use your management NICs. So there's a couple options there. And then you would normally have at least two NICs for your VM traffic. Okay? So you very easily get to 8 nics without much thought process if you're having a lot of HA-capable solution. Okay? Also depends how quickly do you want your VMs to deploy. Okay? The faster the network, the faster your VMs will deploy. Okay? So if your team 210 gig nics, we're expecting as long as your storage can keep up with that, you'll be able to deploy VMs much faster than if you're trying to do it on one 10 gig NIC or a gig network. Okay? We are still seeing, however, we're actually working with a customer at the moment that has teamed 4 1 gig NICs for their storage network. Okay? It works, it's not as fast as 10, but you can still do that sort of thing if that's what you're restricted to with your hardware. We've also had virtual receive side scaling, which provides near line rate to a VM on existing hardware. The VRSS makes it possible to virtualize your traditional network intensive physical workloads. We also extend the RSS functionality built into Server 2012 R2. We're also able to help virtualize systems reach higher speeds with 40 gigabits and 100 gigabit NICs. Okay, so you've got a bit of a hardware change there. So there are some potential fiscal decisions that need to be made about whether or not you can afford the RSSC type NICs. So you need to have hardware that works with any NICs that support RSS. Okay. So the way without RSS, node zero, okay, sends the traffic, incoming packets. We then have node 1, node 2, node 3 across the different CPUs. Without virtual RSS, we have the virtual procs and the virtual machine. So node 1 talks, we get virtual proc. We have the virtual NIC, which then goes and talks to 4 procs. This is without RSS. And then that virtual NIC's talking to the 4 nodes that are trying to communicate across that virtual NIC. So, with IP address management, has anyone actually used IPAM? One person? How many people know that IP address management is part of Windows 2012? A few? Okay. So, we have IP address management that enables us to manage the IP addressing of your environment. We can tightly integrate it with your DNS and DHCP servers, and we can pull in the information about what IPs are being used, what IPs are in your network, and what servers are using those IPs. We're also able to audit the server configuration changes and track IP address usage. So if people change their IPs, we can keep track of that. We can also migrate IP address data from spreadsheets and other tools into the IP address management. So if you're already using some sort of spreadsheet or some other method to keep track of your IP assignment, we can import that into the IPAM system. One of the things we see with a lot of the manual processes customers have deployed over the years is it's great for issuing IPs. A lot of admins don't go back and re-add the IP when they delete a server. Okay? IPAM can help you detect IPs in use and detect which ones aren't in use anymore as well. Okay? So it can flag the ones that aren't being found on the network. But again, it's restricted by what firewalls you have in place and things like that. So the question is IPAM going to be integrated or can be integrated with IP pools in Virtual Machine Manager so that we're not having to have two different processes for IP management? The answer is I haven't heard anything from either the VMM team or the IPAM team on whether that will happen or if it will happen. So unfortunately, I'd love that to see that because I've asked for that as well, but we just haven't seen any responses yet. We haven't seen it. I haven't seen it fully in production yet.
Not in production.
Yeah. So it may be in the code, but it's not in the VMM actual interface. Okay. So some of the things that you can see is IPAM may pick up the IPs, but you can't actually manage it through VMM. Okay. You would have to go to IPAM, and things like that. So we can't do IP address management through VMM other than the IP pools. So we've got to have multiple different interfaces to manage those different solutions. Yep. So the question is, how does IPAM talk to your DNS and DHCP servers? So what you do is you configure IPAM. So when you deploy IPAM, you tell it what DNS and IP and DHCP servers you want it to talk to pull the information in. It also does AD integration and things like that as well. Okay? So the question is, does it have to use AD, or can we use it against machines that aren't in AD? We can use it against machines that aren't in AD, okay? Some people's DNS servers and things aren't domain joined. So as long as there's a record of the IP being either DHCP issued or it's registered in a DNS server, we should be able to pull that information in. So the question is, if the servers aren't registering in DNS, DHCP, or AD, or anything else, how would IPAM know about them? Depending on what firewalls and other things are in the way, because normally if you've got statically assigned machines, they're normally in DMZs, behind firewalls and other things, we may not be able to get to them.
But if the firewall is down, you can
see. So we could potentially scan for it and find it. No, you would if you're not using DHCP and things like that, would have to manually scan.
Does it support the ability to have IP conflicts when we were talking about virtual private networks earlier? Private networks earlier where you can shared addressing between multiple machines?
So the question is, how does it work when we have multiple machines on the same IPs because we've got virtual networks and things like that? So the answer to that is we haven't seen it working very well with the virtual network side things yet, okay? I believe there's still a bit of work to be done with the IP address management. It can work. You can get it to function and be accurate. But the problem is, it's a little bit troublesome still at the moment. But you can get around it. It's just, not very good out of the box. Any other questions? So the IP address management manages the virtual address space in addition to the physical address space, okay? So we can do it. I have found that depending on the number of conflicts you have, so if you have like a real lot of customers using the same IP addresses, you can start running into a few minor issues, okay? If you've only got one or two customers that have conflicting IPs, it's not too bad, but again, it comes to the scale out capabilities. And how many replicas you have of IPs and stuff. Rabbit import and export network configurations automatically through the plugins for System Center Virtual Machine Manager. We also are enabled to synchronizations of active directory sites and subnets information with IPAM. It also supports large-scale enterprise deployments. Okay, we use SQL Server to store all the IP address management information. Okay, so there is a SQL database behind IPAM. It also lets admins define user roles, address scopes, and policies to be able to give granular type security access to IPAM. So when we look at the integration plugin for VMM, okay, we can see that we have the SQL Server on the left, we have our role-based access in the middle, and on the far right, we have our VMM server integration plugins, okay? The IPAM server will go and talk to the DHCP server, the DNS servers, the DC servers or the MPS servers, data collection tasks, server discovery, server configuration, address utilizations, event collection, server availability, server monitoring, address expiry, security groups. We have IPAM administrators, ASM administrators, MSM administrators, IPAM users and audit administrators as well. Okay, it's a tool that will take a little while for you to get used to. There is also an IPAM client for you to be able to connect in with. So dynamic virtual machine queues. So without virtual machine queuing, your pretty much going to be having traffic coming in, and it's going to be using a single CPU. Okay? When we activate virtual machine queues, what we have is we have our three or four CPUs. When traffic comes in, the physical NIC creates a network queue for each VM to reduce the CPU load. Okay? So instead of dropping it all on one CPU, it starts to assign the VM traffic across multiple queues. When we activate dynamic virtual machine queues, what we see is the processor cores dynamically allocate across the CPUs for better performance. Okay? So the dynamic queuing is much more effective than what just the standard virtual machine queues are. NIC teaming. Prior to 2012, if you wanted to do a Windows 2008 NIC team, you would have to install Intel or Broadcom software, or whichever your hardware vendor was would supply you teaming software. In 2012, we removed that requirement. In 2012, Microsoft supplied NIC teaming software built into Windows OS. Okay? You would go in, enable NIC teaming, point to the NIC teaming at the interfaces you wanted to team. Didn't matter if they were the same brand, different brands, we were able to team those NICs. Okay? So I could have my Broadcom NIC and my Intel NIC and I could team them together. There was no complications, no software arguments or anything else. In R2, they've enhanced the load balancing performance. Okay, so when we have our NIC teaming and we're doing active teams, the performance is much better in R2 than what we're seeing in 2012. In 2012, it was pretty good. In R2, it's even better. Again, as I said, it's agnostic to vendors. Doesn't matter what vendor you choose or vendors you put in the same hardware. You can have any vendor talk to another vendor's hardware. We can size teams up to 32 network adapters. Has anyone got a machine with 32? Anyone got a machine with 16? 8? Couple with 8? So we're really starting to talk about really high throughput, especially when we look at 10 gig Ethernet. We're seeing a lot of customers that have still got older hardware on 1 gig doing a lot of teaming. We're able to, with NIC teaming, aggregate the bandwidths from the multiple network adapters. So if we've got 4 1-gig NICs, we get 4 gig of traffic pretty much. We're able to include multiple nodes, and we have a switch-dependent or switch-independent mode. Okay? So if you've gone out and spent the money on some pretty smart switches that know about NIC teaming, then you can turn on the switch-dependent mode. If you've got older switches or dumber switches, you can turn on independent mode, and Windows will sort out the teaming processes and multiple routes.
On the switch side, I assume that's LACP, when you're talking about smart.
Correct. So the question was, are we talking about LACP? If we're talking about smart switches with teaming, yes, we are talking about LACP. Okay? And depending on the vendor, LACP could either be restricted to just one switch, or you can do LACP across multiple switches depending on how you plug them together and things like that. Switch independent mode means that you can have totally different switches. You can have one NIC in switch A, one NIC in switch B, and it'll still combine the two together to get the same throughput. Okay? So it can do the multiple routes. The Windows NIC teaming software delivers that. So the question is, how does the switch know which network path? The switch doesn't. That's why we call it switch independent mode. Okay? The Windows OS and the Windows software itself looks after which NIC is sending traffic, receiving traffic, and the whole traffic management. Okay? Switch dependent mode is where the switch handles the teaming traffic management. So the question is, are we leaning towards giving people advice about leaning towards switch independent mode, or are we still recommending that people go switch dependent mode, even though switch dependent mode can have higher management costs for having to manage the switches manually and taking nicks in and out of the teams and things like that. And ports on the switch in and out of the teaming, etc. The advice is really around what hardware you have and the throughput and performance you want, okay? When you do nick teaming in independent mode, you're putting some workload back onto the Windows host, okay? When you do nick teaming using the offload capability of using switch dependent mode, we're taking that workload of traffic management and putting it on the switch, okay? So you are going to see a performance benefit in switch dependent mode over switch independent mode, okay? So the real answer is, which one would you prefer? Would you prefer the Windows Server doing the workload and have possibly less density because of it? Or are you better off offloading and having some resources given back to the OS and the VMs? So the question is, what about what's the overhead and what's the performance gains and losses? The answer is depending on how many VM workloads you're putting on there. It's very much environmental decision on how your environment is structured and designed. If you're putting high volume, high traffic VMs on an environment, it's going to be a different answer to if you've only got low performing VMs on that environment. So, as I said, we have the operating system which manages those adapters and teams those NICs together. So if we have 8 1 gig NICs, we get 8 gig of throughput. Okay, if you take one NIC out, you lose 1 gig of throughput. The dynamic NIC teaming ensures continuous availability by balancing the network traffic across the NIC teams. Okay? TCP streams or flows are generally not continuous. So we have groups of packets sent between flows, which are called flowlets. Dynamic load balancing detects breaks in the flow of sufficient length to minimize possibility of packet reordering. The flows can be moved to other team members on the flowlet boundaries to rebalance the traffic, okay? So if one NIC in the team all of a sudden starts to become really busy, we can start offloading some of the other traffic to the other NICs, okay? Dynamic LBFO maximizes the resource utilization in your NIC teams by balancing the loads across all the team members. So it's really ideal when there are fewer VMs per team. So SMB multi-channel. So SMB multi-channel is where we're using SMB. The automatic system detects the use of multiple networks and connects between the SMB client and the server using all paths possible. Okay? So if you have two NICs in your server and two NICs in your client, and the server and the client can talk to each other on both NICs, it will use both NICs to send traffic back and forth to your storage, okay? So if you're using SMB, we can do a file copy and it will use both NICs combined to give you better throughput, okay? There is no configuration. It automatically detects that. No, that's not. So the
yep.
So the question is that NIC teaming? And do the NICs actually have their own IPs? The answer is it is not NIC teaming. Each NIC has its own IP on a different range. It's just the fact that the two NICs can see each, so both the server and the client have two NICs on the same IP ranges, and they're able to communicate across both NICs on different ranges.
When you say different ranges, you mean different subnets, just like MPIO would be?
So the question is it similar to the MPIO process where we have two NICs on different IP ranges and subnets? Correct. It's very similar to that. So we're going to be seeing improved throughput. We have bandwidth aggregation through NIC teaming, but we can also have multiple nodes and CPUs for network processing with RSS-capable network adapters as well. The automation configuration has very little administrative overhead. okay? Because it automatically detects them. You don't have to have an admin going and creating teaming or anything of the other solutions. So the file copy will go across both network adapters to the destination. So I'm going to get Craig to come up in a second to do a demo on deduplication, but I'll take a couple of questions. So the question is, would we get better performance out of SMB multi-channel or if we team the NICs together? It really comes down to SMB, you're probably going to be more using that for your storage. Okay, NIC teaming is probably going to be more used for VM traffic. Okay, normally we don't team storage network adapters because we want multi-paths. We want different paths to the storage. So normally we would use MPIO or SMB multi-channel, okay? And we would normally keep NIC teaming as a last resort for storage, and we would use NIC teaming for your VM traffic.
I got a comment on that, I guess.
Yep.
Windows 7 don't support SMB 3, so they wouldn't be able to use SMB multi-channel.
Yeah, so the comment was that we can't use SMB on Windows 7 or Windows 2008. And that's correct. SMB multi-channel is a 2012 R2 Windows 8 type feature. NIC teaming would work if you've got multiple different OSs, okay? But again, it comes down to what your environment is trying to deliver, okay? Normally, we're going to be talking about 2012 servers talking to 2012 servers for your storage. But again, it comes down to what versions of OS and things you're running. So the question is, can we manage the SMB multi-channel so that if we had, for example, two NICs on servers, one was used for is supposed to be used for storage, one's supposed to be used for VMs, but they can see each other. The answer is you can't really manage it that well. My first question would be, why can they see each other on both? Okay, because you wouldn't normally have that environment. Okay, I'll hand over to Craig and he can run you through disk deduplication.
Okay, just bear with me for a second, guys.
So just on that, can I get a show of hands just out of interest? How many people are on 10 gig E now or 10 gig fiber? Okay, how many people are still on 1 gig? Fair few, okay. So yeah, we're just trying to get a feel for the room because depending on the countries we go to, we're seeing very mixed results on who's adopted 10 and who's not. Can I just get a show of hands also? How many people have adopted IPv6? Two people. Can I ask, is there any major reasons why no one's adopting IPv6? Providers?
Still using TMG.
So there's no reason why you can't use it on the back end? Okay. So just a word of advice. If you have customers that like to snoop around your network, The easiest way to confuse them is put IPv6 on. Okay? Now, seriously, we are starting to see people adopt IPv6 for backend. Okay? So your Hyper-V hosts, there's no reason why you can't run IPv6 on the hosts because they're not talking to anything outside. So I would start looking seriously at IPv6, especially if you're starting to run low on IPs and subnets and things like that. But it also makes it harder for people to actually try and identify your servers and things like that, okay? Because as soon as I put an IPv6 address in front of any customer, whether it's a service provider or someone else, they go, what's that? All right? So it is another way of getting security because not everyone's using it yet. Hardly anyone knows what an IPv6 address actually looks like. All right? So it is something that you should start thinking about, okay? It does make it a little bit more secure for you because, as I said, not many people know how to use it. Sorry? I can't hear you, Sastry, sorry.
No, but my question is, probably the trend is more towards the virtualization. That's one of the reasons why everyone is adopting that. Because earlier there was a lack of IP addresses,
yep,
which can be completely avoided with network virtualization.
So one of the other things to keep in mind is there is a lot of good Microsoft technology that relies on IPv6. Okay, there's some new client-facing interfaces. Has anyone used, now that I wanted to talk about it, it's gone out of my head, Direct Access? A couple of you starting to use Direct Access? Okay. Most of you are doing an IPv4 to 6 translation, I'm assuming. Yeah. So there are some technologies that are out there and are coming that work a lot better on IPv6 natively. So keep that in mind as well, that when you start looking at those programs and applications, IPv6 is potentially a better solution for a lot of those products.
Okay.
Ready to go.
Shall we ask work?
Sure. If you turn it on.
Okay, I'll hand you back to Craig now and I'll give my voice a break.
Okay, so I'll quickly run through the dedupe functionality. Excuse me. So first thing you obviously got to do in dedupe is enable it. The easiest way to do it, obviously, is through the GUI. You can do it through the command line, but anyway. Now, it's just a standard server role. So all I've done is gone into computer management and actually selected the add remove features, pick my server. Okay, pick data dedupe, next. Give it a few minutes to quickly go through and enable it. Now once it's enabled, it's not turned on to any volumes by default. You have to go through and enable it. Another drawback of it is you can't specify a folder, it has to be a volume that's deduped. Okay, so back in the server manager. So once you start enabling file shares and file services and that, you'll get the extra functionality of, switch across, of the files and services. In files and services, we've got the normal volumes, now we've got the disks, the new storage pools, shares, iSCSI and the like. So I'll go down to my storage pool. What I've got here is I've just got a single disk of VHD presented to this server that's acting as a storage pool for us at the moment. So what I'll do is I'll create a new disk inside that storage pool. Next. Okay. Okay, so are we actually getting enabled? Okay, so there's nothing fancy about this at the moment. This is where you start to enable storage tiers if you've got it available. Okay, we pick our simple layout of what we want to use. Okay, we don't want to use mirroring or parity at the moment. We're not creating any RAID arrays. In the provisioning here, you've got the option for thin and fixed provision, which is basically the same as dynamic or fixed disks. So I'm going to choose on this one thin. Hit next. Specify my size. Okay. So in creating the disk, it's pretty straightforward. There's nothing too fancy about that. So I'll hit create, and then what I'll do is I'll go back and create another one, but this time I'll change, instead of thin provisioning, I'll change it to fixed. And we'll see what happens. Okay, remove that tick box, don't need that shit. So I'll just go through the same process again, as I said, and create one as fixed. So once those disks are created, they'll actually appear in the bottom section. From here, we can go through the properties of what's actually happening on each of those VHDs that have been created. So I'll just jump into the properties. Okay, so let me just expand those out. And try to get you. So it just goes through and tells you the capacity, the allocated size. So at the moment, it's only allocated 512 meg, so it's not much. We expect that it's a thin provision disk. Okay. So what I'll do now is I'll enable a dedupe. So first thing we'll do is we'll create a volume, new volume, specify which disk we want. We'll start off with the thin provision one for now. I'll set it to the maximum size. I'll give it a default drive letter of D. So here's the first of the dedupe menus. So when you create the volume, you get the opportunity to enable dedupe on this part here. So we'll get an opportunity to enable it. We'll get to tell it how often to run the schedule. We also get some exclusions. Okay. Now those exclusions can be set up if you are doing something really, really bad and have files on that you don't want deduped on the volume. Okay. By theory is that your dedupe volume should have everything be able to be deduped. So you wouldn't put a database or some heavy transaction IO files on there. It's going to be open and closed a lot. So if you did have a file that was being open and closed a lot and wasn't being deduped, you could exclude it at this point here. Okay, so I shall enable. When you enable, you do get general purpose file server as your option of what type of server you want, and the other one is VDI infrastructure server. Okay, I'll pick that. I'll just set that down to there. Okay, so this is a schedule you get to actually do it, do your dedupe. So what we'll do is we'll actually force off the dedupe so we won't go through any of the scheduling part of things. It's generally the same as scheduling a backup, in so to sense. Pick when you want it to run. It'll attempt to run during those periods of time and doesn't finish its job, and move on to the next part. So let's kick it off. Next. Okay, the normal default summary page. Don't worry about bringing that up. What I'll do now is I just repeat the same on the next volume, on the fixed disk that we've got. Okay, so let me just increase the font size on this. Can everybody see that okay? Okay. So what I've got over here is I've got my little cheat file with all the commands in it. So, first thing we'll do, get the volume. So it'll go through and look at our volumes to see which ones have been enabled for dedupe. Obviously, C drive is not here at the moment. That was the only one we didn't enable. So we have two drive letters here. So what we're going to do now is I'm actually going to fill a couple of these up with some space. So what I'll do is I'll jump back across to Explorer. I created a couple of VHDs. So what I've got here is I've got a fixed VHD. So just basically to give us a 3 gig file so we can actually see some optimization happening. I'll paste that onto both volumes. Okay. Now that it's there on the volumes, I'll just duplicate it a couple of times. Okay, so we'll flick back to PowerShell. Okay, same information's there, so let's move across. It's slowly getting those ones up. Now, what we'll do is we'll start the dedupe optimization. So that'll go off. Now, when you're actually firing off this dedupe, there was a setting in the wizard that you would have seen that said how old are the files. Okay, so I've set it to zero. So as soon as I create a file, I immediately want it to be deduped. Okay, if you have that set to obviously 3 months, it's not going to touch a file that's not older than 3 months. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll just grab the status. Okay, so I believe my dedupe job has finished. Okay, so it's in running at the moment, 33% of the way through. Let me just bring that up. So that'll go through. So what we'll do now, flick across to Explorer, and we'll see what happens on the actual disk side of things. So when we're looking at our disk, we can see that our thin provision one, which has 3 copies of files in it, is now actually almost full. Our one that we enabled dedupe on that we're actually doing the optimization on is now down to half the size. Okay, now if we keep on refreshing, she'll go down again. So it's reduced it right down extremely well. So if you're using a VHD share for libraries, especially in dev environments, and you're just caching VHDs that you want to use in future, dedupe them, reduces it right the way down. To undedupe it, you need to make sure you've got enough space on there, but you can just disable the dedupe functionality on that volume, and it will refloat those documents. They'll re-enlarge back to what they were. Is there any question on any of that?
Yep.
Sorry?
It's
a binary compare inside the file. I don't know exactly how big the block size is. I haven't seen the algorithm that they're using for the comparison between the files. Yep.
The file age that you specify, I assume that's the creation date and not the last modified date?
Yep.
Yep.
When new files are added, how often does it work? It's on the schedule, so you can tell it to try to do it as much as you can, like we've got here where we're forcing the jobs to go through, or you set a schedule. And the schedule looks at the age of the file. If the file is old enough, it then performs a dedupe.
So if you wanted to, you could schedule a job to occur every couple of hours or once a night to dedupe that volume. It's up to you if you want to make it a schedule or a manual process.
Yep.
One of the other things with deduplication is they've now enhanced deduplication so that we now have multiple copies of some of the blocks.
Yep.
Okay? So they've added some HA capability to deduplication. And because of that, Microsoft now supports VDI on deduped volumes.
Yep. In 2012, there was
2012 R2 only, okay? We're talking 2012 R2 only. You can use deduplication on a volume, and you can store VDI or terminal server roles on that dedupe volume. You cannot put other workloads on there.
Yep.
It is only for VDI servers.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep. So, what shouldn't you? Anything that's doing basically random access to a disk. So things like a database, exchange databases, even access databases, I wouldn't do it. Anything that's going to be constantly rewriting back and forth into it and making the files deltas change so much it's not going to be compared to anything else. In that case, there's no point. But if I grabbed an ISO library and I said, here's my team, you've got to share, just dump all your ISOs on there and just deduped it. It doesn't matter whether I've got duplicate ISOs on there anymore. They'll just be compressed and put away. Sorry?
So the question was, can we do it on VHDX drives? The only VHDX drives we're allowed to do it on is terminal server VDI.
Yep.
Okay? It depends on how testing and everything else goes. Okay? Technically, you can do it. It's just not supported.
Yep.
Okay? The only support statement is the VDI at the moment. So it's the first step down the path.
Yep. So this is, I think, what, the second generation?
Yeah, it's the second generation of proper true deduplication.
Yep. Yep.
So, my understanding is there's a specific cache for dedupe. So, in some instances, maybe reads are sped up, but writes are slower. Maybe, or I can't remember exactly, something with CSVs, you can't use dedupe, or there's something along with the cache. I guess that was really two questions. There is a read cache for dedupe, correct? Or there is a dedupe cache to help in the process?
There is a caching function that happens on the volumes through storage spaces as well, of what's happening through those. Whether that's directly impact on dedupe, I don't know.
All right, and then what about CSV volumes? Isn't there a limitation to what type of things you can turn dedupe on, or is the only limitation?
I'd have to check to see about the cluster shared volumes.
So
I'm not sure.
You're not natively putting it on a CSV. You're creating a disk or a volume on a CSV. You wouldn't normally create a CSV and then turn dedupe on the CSV.
Yeah.
Okay? You would normally create a volume, put the volume into dedupe mode. And again, it comes down to what workloads you're trying to put on there. But as I said, file shares are supported for dedupe. VDI, VHDX files are supported for dedupe. That's about all. It's not available for all your other virtualization workloads yet.
How do we change the file information after setting the dedupe?
Can you change?
I have an option, right?
Yep.
And 3 months or 0 days or something you select.
Yep.
Is there any way to change that after?
Yep, all through PowerShell. Can all be changed through PowerShell. So when you go through the labs, you'll have a look through all the other PowerShell commands that are available to use. And you can use those to redo the settings.
Okay. Let me just jump back. Okay, so we're going to go into... So the question is around backup solutions and how does backup get affected by deduplication? Okay, the way that it works is the backup software, unless it knows about Microsoft deduplication, it will read everything out as if it's individual files. Okay, so you won't get the same compression that you're getting on the Microsoft Windows dedupe. Okay, if you're using DPM auto dedupes anyway, but some of the other technologies will not see it as a dedupe volume. So some of the storage features we have in Windows 2012 is storage spaces, thin provisioning, and data deduplication, and you're going to be working with those technologies in your labs shortly. We have our SMB server message block direct, so SMB direct. We have SMB multi-channel. We also have ODX, virtual fiber channel, continuous availability with SMB, iSCSI, and NFS. We have comprehensive storage management with the new Windows storage management processes in Server Manager. We also have new Windows PowerShell commandlets. We have integration with SMIS and SMP support for storage solutions that use those technologies. We also have SM APIs. We also have System Center 2012 R2 Virtual Machine Manager able to manage storage for you as well. So it's the storage features we're going to go through in a bit more detail. Thin provisioning, storage spaces, dedupe, storage tiering, application storage on SMB3, virtual fiber channel in Hyper-V. So the vision, all storage visions from most service providers, is to dramatically lower the costs and effort to deliver infrastructure as a service, okay? Especially around the storage services. So we're trying to make sure that the compute and the storage are separated. They shouldn't be linked together. We also have independent manage and scale at each layer. So we want to manage each of the layers separately. We also want to be able to have some industry standards around servers and network and storage. But more importantly, we want inexpensive network solutions and inexpensive storage. Okay? That's the most key thing we're hearing from the industry, is we want cheaper and cheaper storage. Okay? VMs, customers' data is growing in size, so therefore we want to be able to minimize our costs to store that data. So storage spaces. So with storage spaces, what we're doing is we're taking commodity storage, putting it into storage pools and storage spaces. We're making sure that the data automatically can be tiered across memory, SSD, and spinning hard disks. Okay? We really start talking about spinning disks versus SSD instead of SSD, SAS, and SATA. Okay? We also want to be able to make sure we have enough write-back cache to absorb spikes in random writes and also potentially read cache as well. We want to make sure that the solutions that we're coming up with are resilient and have multiple levels of redundancy built into them as well through either N-way mirroring or parity modes. We also want to make sure that the utilization optimized through thin and trim provisioning are enclosure awareness as well. Okay? One of the big things we see is a lot of people start doing thin provisioning, don't monitor it closely, and then they run out of disk. Okay? So thin provisioning is a great tool, but it needs to be monitored closely so that you don't run out of space. Okay? We've had a couple of calls from service providers over the past couple of months where they've done thin provisioning, we've configured it, works great, and then a couple of months later we get a phone call because all their VMs stopped. Okay? Because they ran out of disk. So you need to make sure you're very careful with monitoring your thin provision storage. Integration with other Windows Server 2012 capabilities, but again, capable of different storage solutions and pulling them together and presenting them as a single storage option. So down the bottom, you can see that we have some varying different types of storage, and we have SSD, we have HDD, spinning disks, which are HDD, and those spinning disks can be SSD, SAS or SATA. So what we do is we create storage spaces based on that hardware. Once we've created our storage spaces in our Windows virtualized storage layer, we then start moving in to managing that solution. We can have other technologies use it. So we can manage the Windows storage spaces with PowerShell. We can manage the. We can use that same storage for failover clustering. We can use it for CSV volumes. We can have Hyper-V use it. We can also format it with NTFS, REFS, or NFS. We can also do storage QoS on that platform, as well as SMB multi-channel or SMB direct. And then on top of that, we have our Windows application servers or file servers, which are physical or virtualized deployments. So storage tiering. We have some enhancements with the cost efficiencies of storage tiering. We have inbox storage virtualization solutions which automatically tier. We have improved storage cost performance with that same sort of hardware. I've had some discussions with people already over the last couple of breaks around people looking at different hardware solutions that can deliver that storage tiering. We can use solid-state drives and hard drives in tiered storage solutions so that we can have different price points and different product offerings. We can also pin high-priority files to the SSD tier. So we can say specific types of files should be run on SSD instead of your physical hard drives. So what we have is hot data and cold data. What we really want is the cold data stored on your physical disks and the hot data stored on your SSD drives. Because the hot data are the files that are being accessed all the time. So SMB file shares are fully supported for a lot of workloads now. So we really want to be able to have clustered Windows servers which access the shared disk. Okay, the Windows cluster, it then presents the SMB share. So we have a single logical file share that your Hyper-V hosts connect to, or your SQL cluster connects to, or any of the other applications that will start using SMB share can connect to. So a perfect example of one of the benefits of SMB shares is I no longer have to go to my Hyper-V hosts and configure iSCSI targets, or configure the HBAs and the WWNs to allow access to the storage. All I'm doing is pointing my Hyper-V host at an SMB share and saying, that is the location to create and store your VMs. Okay? So from a management perspective of physical boxes, it can be a far simpler management cycle as well. So it gives us a level of more flexibility as well as easier provisioning processes as well. The SMB also gives us the near-line rate performance for both small and large I/O. Okay? We have seen some performance benefits because of the caching capabilities of having a Windows cluster in front of traditional SAN storage or in front of cheaper commodity-type storage. So as I said, Hyper-V, SQL, two main workloads that we're seeing SMB starting to be utilized for, other than your traditional file shares, etc. There is also built-in encryption support if you want to do encryption as well. So again, we can have our SAN with different types of storage in it, or we can have cheap commodity disk behind it in your SAS, JBODs, etc. And we can also put behind it storage spaces on those JBODs. So one of the benefits of using an SMB share is that we're able to scale it out. So if we're finding that the performance is starting to struggle, we can just add another Windows server to the cluster and scale out that SMB share. Okay? By adding more nodes, we get more throughput and we get better performance. Okay? So we can also avoid unnecessary traffic redirection because the system automatically load balances the requests coming into the environment. Okay? So when we have our SMB share, we can have multiple servers hitting that SMB share, and that every time a new server request comes in, it will go to the Windows server that has the least amount of transactions or file requests going to it. Okay? So if I have three servers in my Windows cluster supplying that SMB share, it will go to the node that has the least amount of work happening on it. We also have offloaded data transfer. So if you have intelligent storage arrays that have the ODX capability, we can activate it. So instead of the file servers copying the data off the storage, sending it across your network and then down to another storage device, we can actually have the two storage devices communicate and directly copy the files between the two storage devices. It means we get faster transfers of larger files. We also get less CPU and network utilization on the physical host because we've offloaded that copy process to the storage arrays. So the offload copy request goes down from the server to the virtual disk. The actual data is sent after we send a token to the server. That server passes the token to the destination server. The token is passed down to the virtual disk on the array, and then the actual data is copied between the two arrays. Okay, it doesn't go back up to the server and across and back down again. It goes directly from array to array. virtual fiber channel in Hyper-V. We now can pass through the fiber channel connections through to your VMs. So if you want your VMs to directly attach to your SANs, okay, we can do that through the virtual fiber channel HBAs. We can now have up to 4 virtual fiber channel adapters on a virtual machine. Okay? So if you have virtual fiber channel requirements on your VMs, you can only assign 4 virtual HBAs to a VM. Personally, I haven't seen many service providers need 4 HBAs. Most people are normally using 1 or 2 for MPIO, and that's about all. We can also use virtual fiber channel for live migration. Okay? So if you do have HBAs, you can, or virtual fiber channel or fiber channel, we can use that for live migration as well. So if we want to do a virtual live migration from one physical host to another host, we can do that across your fiber channel network. With efficient storage through data deduplication, we're able to get better performance in a VDI scenario. Okay? We've got low CPU and memory impact by using deduplication. It's not a large overhead on the file servers that are using deduplication. It's configurable and the compression schedule can be set. It's transparent to primary server workloads. The servers don't know that everything is sitting on a dedup volume to the server. It just looks like it's on normal storage. Okay? So if you've got a server accessing a remote share that's deduped, it won't know the difference. We've improved the reliability and integrity because we now store redundant metadata and critical data. Okay, so there's multiple copies of the metadata as well as any critical data that we need to keep. Checksums and integrity checks are run. We also increase the availability through the redundancy of not keeping as little blocks as what we used to. Okay, so the number of block copies we keep of files has increased a little bit, so the compression's still very good. There's very little impact on keeping those extra redundant versions. Now, one of the other features is if we have branch cache, okay, you'll get better performance. Does anyone here actually have used branch cache before? No? Okay. Branch cache is a technology Microsoft released a couple of years ago. Okay, branch cache is where if you activate branch cache on a machine, it will look for a local copy before it goes to a destination that's potentially further away. Okay, so if a local machine that's close has a copy of the file already, it will grab it from there instead of going to a file share that may be further away. Okay. So if you use branch caching or activate branch caching, you can get benefits because instead of going to the original source, it can get it from a closer or faster source. Thin provisioning. We're allocating just enough space to get the systems up and running, and then we increase just in time to get the server and keep the server functional. Okay? Again, as I mentioned, though, you do have to be careful because you need to make sure that you have enough space in case all of the VMs or all the VHDX files all of a sudden grow. Okay? If customers start going running disk defrags and check disks on their drives, it will blow out their drives to full capacity instead of keeping them dynamic and thin. Okay? There are some new APIs which allow applications to release storage when they're no longer needed. Okay? So there's been some performance increases in the way that we reclaim storage space on a drive or on a thin provisions volume. So here we increase the storage available as required just in time for the server that needs it. We also then can capture back storage when it's no longer needed. Deduplication should not be used for production VMs other than VDI. Okay? Microsoft does not support dedup for production workloads other than VDI. And it's only on 2012 R2. Don't turn dedup on older versions and expect it to be supported. Deduplication is best for your library stores and your VM backups or Hyper-V replica. Okay? If you're replicating VM somewhere, it's a good place to be able to use deduplication as well. Because those servers aren't necessarily updating very frequently. Deduplication is also more efficient for duplicated data, so you're going to get much better performance and reduction in storage size on files that have repetition than unique files. Okay, so VHDXs, ISOs, in your VMM libraries are going to be a great source for deduplication. And again, don't oversubscribe your thin provisioning volumes. Make sure that you monitor them closely for how much space is left. We have unified storage management with SMIS and WMI. So we have our management server, which is our file server manager, or you could have third-party applications or Microsoft System Center Virtual Machine Manager. The storage management APIs are available through PowerShell and WMI, or we can also have some pass-through APIs for extensibility with the WMI. The storage management provider, or SMP interface, goes and then talks to Windows standard-based storage management services. So if you've got Windows storage spaces or Windows file servers running cluster CSVs and things like that, we're able to manage that through that process. Or we can use SMP to go and talk to third-party types of storage devices. So Virtual Machine Manager manages storage for you. Okay? If you have compatible storage, you can have VMM mount volumes create LANs, mount volumes on those LANs, and then get your Hyper-V host starting to provision onto those LANs. So the question was, does it support SMIS? Yes, SMIS is one of the options we have in VMM to be able to manage that storage layer. Yes, the storage has to talk at SMIS. So we can do SAN discovery with Fibre Channel, iSCSI, and SAS. We can also do NAS discovery, so we can also get VMM to use NAS and discover NASs. We have file server discovery for Windows scale-out file servers doing SMB. We have SAN, NAS, and file server discovery levels that you can pre-configure. We also have level zero provider subsystem arrays, file servers and all relevant associations. Level one, we have storage pools, file shares and all relevant associations. Level two is LUN, masking sets, initiator ports and arrays. And level three is physical disks and all relevant associations to those physical disks. With VMM, we can do capacity management. So we can do the pools, the volumes, the file share classifications. We can also file share ACL management. We also have bare metal deployment of file servers. So we can also use it to go and deploy failover clusters and deploy anything we need in our cloud environment, pretty much. We can add and remove file server nodes from a file share cluster. We also have the discovery of physical spindles, storage pool creations and deletions. So if we're adding hosts or servers into VMM to manage for storage, we can deliver that as well. We can also configure mirror and parity spaces creation and deletion as well if you're using storage spaces.